Thank you, Prem. Thank you, Sai Prakash. And dear listeners, Sai Ram from Prashantinilayam, the most happening place on the planet, as I always say. And in a few days from now, we will be submerged and suffused in the sublime and subtle vibrations of Mahashivaratri. In Prashantinilayam, it is being celebrated on February 28th, Friday. So the bhajans will commence on the 9th, on the night of 28th February from 6 p.m. and it will go on till 6 a.m. on Saturday, March 1st, 12 hours of Akhanda Bhajan. And Shivaratri invariably brings back memories of those spectacular years when Bhagwan used to perform Vibhuti Abhishekam on the Shirdi Sai idol and the Lingodbhavam. In fact, if you go to our website, you can read a wonderful account of these episodes narrated by Miss Janet Bok, one of the earliest devotees from the West, who was present to witness Shivaratri personally in the early 70s. And there are very beautiful pictures too. You can really go back in time to those beautiful days when these scintillating events were part of Bhagwan's Leelas on the day of Shivaratri. The crescendo of the bhajan singing used to be on Shivaratri nights, and it will go on and on. So whenever this really takes your mind back to those really surcharging, recharging vibrations of Shivaratri, and how, and as the singing goes high pitched, you know, you'd see Bhagwan. In 1999 I was there, and suddenly, spontaneously, Swami just got up from his chair and out emerged from his divine mouth, the lingam. Lingodbhavakara Lingeshwara. The bhajans would go on, and suddenly you would see Bhagwan doing this fascinating manifestation of divine power. And every time the Lingodbhavam happened, after that, Bhagwan always had a divine message. In fact, when I was thinking of Shivaratri and the legends associated with it, in the light of what Bhagwan always says, it just occurred how there are so many beautiful messages, so delightfully packaged, so delightfully packed in our legends. It is said Shivaratri is the night when the marriage of Shiva and Parvati happened. But what does this really mean? What is this marriage of the one who actually has no beginning, no end? Who is marrying whom, and where and when and how? Well, I think this is something very relevant for us to ponder on. And this is what we will be doing tonight. I will first share with you some of my reflections on these legends associated with Shiva, Shakti and Shivaratri. And then I will also play for you a very insightful session that I had once with an Anglican priest, Father Francis Kumaran Subrayan, and the understanding he has of Indian deities and Indian culture and their universality is something very unique and very profound. So we will listen to Father Kumaran and think about these wonderful stories associated with the Lord, with Shiva and Shakti and their inherent, latent, deep meanings. So that is what we have in the next 90 minutes or so in this Thursday Live. You're listening straight from the studios of Radio Sai.
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
So welcome to Outside, Inside, Deep Inside on Thursday night. I am Team Radio Sai's Bishu. I offer my humble salutations at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet as we embark on this fresh episode of Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. And as I told you, the first thing we are going to discuss today is the story of Shivaratri. As I mentioned, some believe that it is the night when Shiva danced the Tandava. Some say it is the period when Shiva drank the Halahala poison to save the world. And according to some others, it is the occasion when Shiva wedded Shakti. Well, let's take this latest story, this latter story of Shiva and Shakti coming together. Now, what does this marriage mean? Swami has explained that it is the emergence of the Jivatma with the Paramatma, the individual soul, finally losing itself in the Supreme Soul, the Supreme Being. And Shivaratri is an ideal setting for this to happen because, as Swami has explained, the moon has 16 kalas or 16 fractions of divine glory, 16 attributes, and each day, or rather each night, during the dark fortnight, one fraction is reduced. So you see the moon waning until it happens when the entire moon is annihilated on the new moon night. You don't see the moon at all. And from then on, again, each fraction is added, 16 fractions, until when the moon becomes a full circle on the full moon night. And Swami says, the moon is the presiding deity of the mind. Just like the mind waxes and wanes, the moon waxes and wanes, it fluctuates. And that is why in the Vedas it is said, Chandrama Manaso Jata. That is, out of the manas, out of the mind of the Supreme Being, moon was born. So it must be remembered, Swami says, that the chief aim of all sadhana, of all spiritual striving, is to actually eliminate the mind. And that's a very difficult thing to achieve, to become amanaska, as they say, to eliminate the mind. But during the dark fortnight of the moon, if one does sadhana, it becomes easier to reach that state. And Swami says, as each fraction of the moon reduces on the night of Chaturdasi, there is a 14th day, which is the night of Shiva, only a fraction remains. So if some special effort is made that night, when the moon is at its weakest, then with some intense and vigilant sadhana, with some puja, with some dhyana, with some concentration and meditation, it becomes easy to attain the Shiva consciousness, to experience that bliss, that is Shiva, that is auspiciousness. But this happens every month, so what is special about Shivaratri? Swami says it's an occasion once a year to make that special spurt of spiritual activity, so that our path towards Shivoham, from Shavam to Shivam, as Swami says, Shavam is a lifeless person. A lifeless person is one who has no awareness of God in his or her life. So moving from Shivam to Shavam to Shavam to Shivam, Shivam is the embodiment of perpetual awareness of God. So how can we achieve this? How can we achieve that awareness, that consciousness, that Shiva consciousness? And for this story of Shiva and Parvati coming together actually gives us many clues. There are plenty of secrets embedded in this story of the union of Shakti with Shiva. So let's go to that story. The legend goes that Lord Shiva's consort, Sati, was the daughter of King Daksha. And on one occasion, King Daksha performed a huge sacrifice, but he did not invite his daughter or Shiva, his son-in-law, to that sacrifice. Now Sati, nevertheless, wanted to go for that event, and she in fact went for that event, even though Shiva had warned her about this visit, because Shiva knew that Daksha always disliked Shiva and he was never happy of giving his daughter in marriage with Shiva. That marriage happened, but Daksha was not happy at all. That marriage happened because Sati wanted Shiva, but Daksha was never pleased with this marriage, and he always did not like Shiva because he felt Shiva is someone who is so unorthodox, someone who wears a snake, someone who has deer skin all around him, who roams around in burial grounds, who has ash on his body and long matted hair. So he had no liking for such a personality. And so Shiva actually advised Sati not to go, because they were not invited, but Sati wanted to go. And so what happens is, when Sati reaches there, in the court, in that huge assembly of distinguished guests, Daksha insults his daughter. Not only his daughter, but also her husband. And Sati cannot take that ridicule. She's so upset, she's so dejected, she feels so terrible that she feels I don't have to live to hear such harsh words. And she immediately reduces herself to ashes with her yogic power. Then and there, she just becomes lifeless. And when Shiva comes to know of this, he is furious. He takes a strand out of his hair and out of it creates a warrior. He creates Veerabhadra with the mission to go and destroy that sacrifice. And Veerabhadra beheads Daksha. And after this is done, finally, when Shiva comes to the scene, he sees the destruction around and also the headless body of his father-in-law Daksha. And compassion fills the heart of the Lord, and he decides to give life to him, give life to Daksha. And so he places on Daksha's head now the head of a goat. And then Shiva is utterly devastated seeing what Sati had done to herself. And so Shiva now lifts and carries that lifeless body of Sati and goes around the three worlds in sorrow, in dejection, in desolation. And the gods do not know how to end this pitiable state of Shiva, how to bring back Shiva. And finally Lord Vishnu, through his Sudarshana Chakra, through his disc, dissects the body of Sati into 52 pieces. And this gets scattered all over the earth. And that is how today we have Shakti Peets in so many parts of earth, at various places, where Shakti, the aspect of Shiva, is worshipped. So let's pause the story at this point and reflect before we proceed. Now what is very evident is King Daksha had no clue who Shiva is. That is the reason why he disliked Shiva. That is the reason why he had no respect for him. Instead of adoring the Lord, instead of feeling blessed to be a part of the Lord's family, he actually even went to the extent of insulting his wife Sati for marrying Shiva. Shiva, the Lord of the world. And today, if you see, that's what we have. We have intellectuals and scientists, we have rationalists and atheists who, because of gathering a few knowledge, few trivial success in understanding a tiniest of the tiny part of nature, they feel that there is no need for them to accept and acknowledge a supreme power above them. They actually, because of their insignificant achievements, they are filled with so much ego that in that ego, they insult and abuse nature. Nature. Just like Daksha abused Sati. They forget the relationship with nature. Sati is nature. It is the energy principle of Shiva which animates the creation. It is Prakriti. Shiva is the Purusha. So today you have people who use and overuse and misuse and exploit nature. But they have no respect or reverence for her. They don't treat earth or nature as mother goddess, as a divine principle. Just like Daksha ridiculed Sati. And so, as a result, just like Sati took the drastic step of destroying herself, today we have nature destroying herself, nature showing that anger. You have the upheavals happening, you have earthquakes happening, you have unexpected tsunamis happening, you have so many natural calamities. Every other month you hear something devastating happen somewhere. And if these are all signs of nature being immensely displeased, being frustrated with what is happening, what is being done to her. And what does Shiva do? Shiva intervenes. Shiva comes to help. And because of his love and compassion and his mercy, just like he restored life to Daksha, in spite of Daksha committing so many grievous mistakes, Daksha repents. Daksha finally understands his folly and Shiva gives life to Daksha. But Shiva gives Daksha the head of a goat. Why? Possibly symbolically meaning that God puts us through so many situations so that those of us who have big heads like Daksha, we finally have our ego heads beheaded. And how does that happen? Only a shock will humble us. So you have something happens in your life which totally defies logic and reason, and adversity that no one ever imagined happens in your life. And then all these big heads that we have, all these huge egos become humbled and they become destroyed. They become destroyed, but they are not out. And that is why God rescues but still gives a goat head, because even though repentance has happened, all the negative traits are not gone yet. All the animal tendencies have not disappeared yet. They are still there. There are still so many bestial tendencies which need refinement. And so, yes, you are given a new birth, but there is a long way to go before you can have a human head. Because once when you had a human head, you grossly misused it. And then, see the way Vishnu disperses the limbs of Sati all over the earth. That only shows how Sati pervades the entire earth. The earth gets sanctified by the touch of her limbs, and everywhere a part of her being falls, a temple rises. And that is how you have Kamakshi, you have Jayadurga, you have Dakshayani, Kali, Shivani, Uma, so many temples, 52 shrines all over Asia. What this means is that she is the one who sanctifies the earth, who makes this earth holy. She is present in every speck of this earth, the length and breadth of this land. She is nature. She gets subsumed into nature, into Mother Earth. But the story of Sati does not end there. She actually assumes a form again. And that is the story of Parvati, Mother Parvati. So what happens is, after Sati is gone, Shiva goes into seclusion and deep meditation. And meanwhile, on earth, there is this powerful demon by name Tarakasura. The earth is gripped by the atrocities of this demon Tarakasura, who is very powerful, who's received plenty of boons from all the gods, and now no one is able to defeat him. And Lord Brahma, the creator, says that given the demon's invincibility, only the son of the Lord, only the son of Lord Shiva can annihilate this ferocious evil. But Shiva is now in deep meditation and Sati is no more. What to do? So the devas now pray to the divine goddess, to that divine energy principle, to incarnate again. And so she is reborn from earth, from the mountains. And that is why she is called Parvati. Parvati means one from the hills. She is now the daughter of the Himalayas. Now why Himalayas? Well, I think Himalayas represent the glorious earth. The stoutness, the beauty, the grandeur, the grace, the majesty, everything that is spectacular about this earth is there in the Himalayas. It's a very beautiful representation of what earth is. And so, Parvati is born as the daughter of Himalayas from the earth again. And right from her childhood, the little Parvati is captivated by Lord Shiva. She loves playing with the Shivalingam. She doesn't like any toys or any friends. And eventually, as she grows in the Shiva Bhava, always thinking about Shiva, she comes of age and the fame of her beauty and intelligence spread all over the lands, and there are so many eager to marry her, but she refuses all because she says her interest is only Shiva. I do not want anyone else in this life. She very clearly tells her father, my heart is given to Lord Shiva. Period. Now her father Himavan, the Himalayas, is flabbergasted and is worried. Because yes, it's a great dream to achieve Lord Shiva, but Lord Shiva is the Lord of the world, and how on earth are we going to achieve this? Moreover, Shiva is entered into deep penance after Sati's disappearance. And that is how, what happens next is, Himavan takes Parvati and goes to Lord Shiva's abode. And Himavan requests Shiva to allow her daughter to serve him. And Shiva agrees. And so Parvati stays there and she serves the Lord, even as Shiva is engaged in tapas most of the time. So she cleans the place, she brings flowers, and she ensures that the entire area is properly maintained. And she spends her time, all the free time, gazing at the Lord when the Lord is engaged in meditation. And the plan was, her father thought and the other gods thought, that once Parvati goes to the vicinity of Shiva and she starts serving Shiva, Shiva would be enamored with her beauty, and soon it would be very easy to convince Shiva to marry Parvati. That's what the plan was. But what actually happened is something else. Shiva could not be distracted. His concentration was unruffled. Nothing could disturb his attention. And now everyone started wondering what to do. And so the devas asked Kamadeva, the god of desire, to fire his arrows on Lord Shiva. And what happens as a result is that the moment Kamadeva does that, Shiva is unimaginably enraged at the audacity of Kamadeva to destabilize his penance. And so Shiva in fury opens his third eye and destroys Kamadeva. Kamadeva is reduced to ashes. And it doesn't stop there. Shiva orders Parvati, I do not desire your services anymore. You may go back to your father and never again try to work your charms on me. Parvati pleads with Shiva and asks him to let her continue to do the service, but Shiva is unmoved. And so the utterly dejected Parvati retreats, but not to the house of her father, but to a grove in the Himalayas. Because after being with Shiva for so long, her love for the Lord had only increased. Now she had no interest in anything else, no interest in life that did not have Shiva in it. She now decides that she has to perform penance, however intense it may be, till she wins her Lord. And that is what she does. And in fact, once she begins this rigorous sadhana, this intense meditation, with time, she realizes so much more about herself. As she meditates more, as she goes inward more, she discovers so many things about her that she had never known. Her life gets revealed to her. She realizes that she indeed is the incarnation of Sati. She is in fact the Mahashakti. She is not just a daughter of Himavan. She is in fact that energy principle. Her destiny is ultimately to unite with the Lord. she realizes who she really is. And once that realization dawns, she gets more and more convinced that her love for the Lord transcends everything. And she just loses herself in meditation, in prayer, and in contemplation. And she realizes that she will be incomplete without her Lord. And that incompleteness will remain till she becomes one with her beloved. And now her penance becomes so intense. She gives up food, water, sleep, rest, everything. And her tenacity baffles the gods. The story goes that the power being generated from her penance is so great that it overwhelms and unsettles the gods, Brahma and Vishnu. They feel the heat of her tapas, her penance. And it is at this point that the gods approach Shiva and tell him of this incredible pining of Parvati. And the next day, as Parvati is about to begin her penance, she sees a young ascetic standing in front of her and looking at her keenly. And so she asks this young ascetic, "Is there a reason why you are staring at me in this manner?" And the young ascetic says, "Oh lady, I have been watching you for so many days. I have never seen anyone do penance with this much rigor. You don't realize anything that is happening around you. You are so magnificent in your sadhana. Your sadhana is so powerful. I am just wondering what would prompt a lady like you to undertake such a penance. I mean, what would be that much worth that you are going through so much to attain?" And Parvati replies, "Yes, what I want to attain is love. I am doing all this for love. I am doing all this for my Shiva. I want him in my life. I want to win him with my devotion." And then the young ascetic, when he hears this, suddenly the young ascetic actually pretends as if he's surprised and he actually spontaneously laughs. And Parvati is taken aback. I mean, she said such a serious thing and the young ascetic is laughing, taking it, making it so light. And the young ascetic says, "I mean, you want to marry Lord Shiva, that three-eyed one who is so weird? I mean, you want to waste your beauty and intelligence on someone like that? Someone who smears ashes, someone who wears skulls, who sits on a bull, who has snakes on his body, who is so funny? Lady," and I forgot to tell you, lady, that he's actually homeless. He lives on a mountain. He just roams around in graveyards. I mean, is it all worth it? Do you think you really, really want Shiva?" And the moment Parvati hears this, her eyes start blazing. She doesn't want to hear one more word about Shiva in such a deriding manner. And she says, "Yes, I mean that Shiva. I mean that Shiva who is the master of the three worlds." And she continues, "I mean that Shiva who can never be understood by puny minds like yours." And even before the ascetic could utter another word, Parvati fiercely warns, "Do not say one more word. It is not only a sin to talk like this, it is a bigger sin to listen to such rubbish." And Parvati just turns and she's about to just flee from the scene, just go away from there. And just then a flash happens and the young ascetic disappears and in his place is standing Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva, her Shiva, her beloved. And Shiva now looks tenderly at Parvati, at his sati. The test is over and Sat Shakti gets united with Shiva. And that is why we celebrate Shivaratri. Now that is the story, but isn't it so symbolic? First, let's take a few things. Out of the earth comes Parvati, just like every individual is born on earth. And like Parvati, everyone wants to win the grace of the Lord. Everyone wants the Lord's favor. But first we think that we can manage to get this grace through our charms, through our intelligence, through our deals. We say, God, if you do this for me, I will break 10 coconuts, or I will go to Tirupati and shave off my hair and things like that, as if God needs our coconuts and our hair. We try so many things to manipulate the Lord, just like Kamadeva did. And we spend years doing this. And what happens in the end? Kamadeva is destroyed. When Bhagwan's physical form was there, when Swami was here, you'd see how every student and how devotee would try to get the Lord's attention. Someone, some plan, some strategy. I will sit here, I will come with that group, I will wear this sari, I will wait at this point, and so on. And all these schemes and all these devious plans are just in one instant destroyed by the Lord. That's what Lord Shiva does to Kamadeva. And what does Lord Shiva due to Parvati? He rejects her. He rejects her. He rejects her service. Because, as Bhagwan says, there is no point serving me if your mind is not pure. If you are not working towards Chitta Suddhi, or if you are not working towards purifying yourself, and if you are only strategizing, thinking of only clever means of attaining me, it's of no use. And so what Parvati does now? Parvati, who was with the Lord for so long, cannot think of moving away from the Lord. Just like so many of us, even though we may not have succeeded in attaining the Lord's grace, but we cannot leave the Lord either, because we are in some ways being touched by Him. We know that there is nothing as beautiful, as serene and as lofty compared to this. So even though we are rejected, even though we are sent back, even though Swami is not talking to us, even though He is not responding, we still cannot move away from Him. We cannot think of going away from Him. And then, like Parvati, we determine to self-examine, and we determine to achieve our goal, and now we are willing to do any sacrifice to attain Him. Just like Parvati forgot her food, sleep, rest. Somehow I have to win my Lord's grace. And that's what, when this self-introspection happens, we all want to go all out to have Him. Nothing else matters, nothing else is important, and it is then that our journey of self-discovery begins. Then we go deeper and deeper within, and we realize, oh, I am actually so much a part of the Lord. Just like Parvati discovered that she is a part of Shiva, so every individual soul finally realizes, oh, I am His part, I completely belong to Him. Just like Parvati realized that she is indeed an inseparable part of Lord Shiva, and that only increased the determination to unite with the Lord. Same with every soul. Once we go deep, we realize how our goal should be only to return to the Lord and become one with Him, because only then can we experience that perfect peace, that perfect bliss, that perfect happiness. So when this realization dawns, and we are about to cross that final frontier in our sadhana, at that point, God, before He grants us that ultimate union with Him, He wants to check. He wants to test. And that's what happens with Parvati. Shiva comes in the guise of an ascetic, and He foo-foos her idea and her effort. Just like it might happen to any of us in this world. You will find people making reckless comments on your work, on your sadhana, when you know that what you're doing is the best thing to do. That is the best adventure, the best romance, the best penance that one can be engaged in. But you will still find people ridiculing it. And at that point, God is just waiting to see our reaction. Parvati did not even bat an eyelid. She could not tolerate even the slightest of words which were not spoken in good taste about Shiva. But not even a stray thought came to her. Oh, okay, this ascetic, probably he's saying the right thing. Maybe I did not think of Shiva in this way. Maybe, okay, there are people who don't think, consider Shiva as handsome. If I fall in love with Shiva, what will people think of me? She did not think of any of those things. She was very clear in her mind that she wanted Shiva, Shiva and Shiva and nothing else. And that is how it should be for every devotee. There will be times when doubts would come to your mind. There will be so many people who want to change and question your track. But those are occasions to see, are we on the path? Are we willing to compromise, or are we willing to be steadfast to our principles? Are we getting distracted? or are we focused, come what may? So when Shiva is fully convinced of Parvati's absolute purity and her pure intent and her unconditional acceptance and love for the Lord, then Lord Shiva reveals himself and gives himself to her. That is the journey of every soul. It is at that point that every soul finds that fulfillment. And we must also remember at this point that when people ridicule us, it is just God in disguise who is testing us. The young ascetic was Lord Shiva himself. All that the Lord is interested in is that we pass the test. He wants us to pass the test so that he can confer the blessing on us. But test is a must. As Swami says, tests are the taste of the Lord. Because only when you pass a test can you go up. So here again, whenever we undergo through these tests, we must know that it is all coming from the Lord. It is coming from the Lord in disguise because he wants to lift us. So when Parvati passes the test, she is united with Shiva. And when Shiva and Shakti unite, there is welfare for the world. Because the son of Shiva, Kartikeya, kills the demon Tarakasura. Similarly, when we unite our heart with the Lord, we become the Lord's amazing instrument for the welfare of the world. So that is the story. And those are some of the things to ponder on. Every story of the Lord, every Purana of the Lord, you know, as we call in Indian culture the Puranas, they are not mere stories. They have come to us by people who are in tune with the Lord. And there are timeless messages encased in the stories. And these messages are there in this form because it is only through stories that these messages can be passed on from generation to generation. Like this, if you look at every temple, every deity, everything has a tale, everything has a story, everything has a Purana. And it is for us to dwell deep. The Puranas and the stories keep the memory alive, keep the essence alive, keep the thing alive, but we have to listen to them and then reflect. When we dwell deep, then we gather those precious pearls carefully hidden in them, and that will make our lives shine. Recently I was in Tiruvannamalai and had the chance to visit the shrine of Arunachaleshwara, one of India's most ancient Shiva temples. And the Lord here is on the Annamalai mountain, and the goddess is called as Unnamulai. As I went around this temple, I was reminded of how just a month ago I had a beautiful conversation with an Anglican priest, Father Kumaran, Francis O'Brien, and he explained to me the inner significance of every aspect of this temple. And as I was walking and visiting every shrine in this temple, I was reflecting on what he had told me. And the whole visit became such an ennobling experience, such a revealing experience. Fortunately, on that occasion, I had had the chance to record this conversation with Father Francis from South Africa, who has been practicing for more than 6 years as an Anglican priest in Africa. So now I am going to play for you this conversation. Listen to this intently. It will give you a whole new perspective of Indian deities and the universality of the gods revered in Indian culture since times immemorial. Sairam and welcome, Father Francis Kumaran, to the studios once again. You have been serving as an Anglican priest in South Africa. For the last 1 year, you have been spending time in contemplation in the Manashram in Arunachala, which is also the abode of Lord Shiva. Can I ask you, as a Christian priest, when you step into the temple of Lord Shiva in Arunachala, what goes in your mind? What happens to you? How is the feeling when you step inside the shrine of Lord Shiva at Arunachala?
For me, Bishu, Shiva, specifically in his form as Arunachala, is the revelation of God the Father that Jesus spoke about. The Jewish people saw this as Yahweh or Jehovah. And so when Jesus spoke of the Father, they equated that to Yahweh or Shiva. But as someone from an Indian background and a South Indian Tamil background, for us, Shiva has been that supreme. So where the Jews called it Yahweh or Jehovah, my family called it Shiva. And so for me, connecting with Shiva is really connecting with my roots and saying that I don't need to go to the Jewish revelation to find a name for the supreme mystery. Because the God is ultimately nameless, is beyond any name. But if I had to find a name that resonates with me as someone of Indian descent, then the name that I give to the Father of Jesus is the name Shiva, which means absolute bliss, the all auspicious one. And so that is the main thing for me as I step into the temple, is that I am coming to experience the one supreme God of the universe, whatever you call him. And so as I enter, I'm very aware that there is only one God, and we perceive this God in different names and in different forms. You see, many people may go into a Hindu temple and see all these images and say, and this is what the Western missionaries did, instead of actually just studying a little bit deeper what was Hinduism about, they labeled it as a polytheistic religion. And they said, oh, these people worship many gods, you know. But if they just searched a little deeper, they would have realized, no, it's actually only one God, and that one God in many forms and many names. In other words, each deity for me is a different aspect or a different characteristic of the one God. It's like when the one light shines through the clouds, we get the rainbow. And this rainbow has so many colors in it. Yes. But it's only one light shining, you know. It's like sitting in a church and seeing the light come through the stained glass window. So many different colors are there. Yes. But if you go and it's creating a picture that helps us adore God.
Yes.
But if you go beyond the stained glass, you see it's only one light that is shining. And that's God. For our benefit, he allows his one light to shine through a stained glass window, if you want to call it that. And so we see different colors, different aspects, which helps us perceive the great mystery. Because the intensity of the light on itself, we might not be able to manage it, leave alone comprehend it. And so he makes it simple for us.
And so simple so that you fall in love with it first.
Exactly, exactly. It draws us. And then as we go deeper, we experience the ultimate that is beyond name and form. But we have to start off with name and form before we get to the nameless, formless reality of the divine. And so as I go through the temple, Arunachala Ishwara temple, or any temple for that matter, as I experience each deity, I acknowledge a certain aspect of God. Now, I have said early on, for me, Christ is my guru. He is the one that leads me to the experience of God. And I feel a deep connection with him even as I enter the temple. It's not separated from my Christianity in any way or my belief in Jesus. That Jesus as my guru is with me and he's teaching me and he's revealing the deeper aspects of his Father who I've come to know and love as Arunachala Shiva. He's revealing those different aspects to me. So, when I enter the temple, like most Shiva temples, the first deity you encounter is Lord Ganesha. So there's Ganapati there. Now, since a child I had a profound love for Ganapati. In fact, even before any other image of God attracted me, it was the image of Ganesha that attracted me. Very appropriate for one on the spiritual path that Ganesha should be the first God that attracts me. And so I used to love elephants. You know, when I was young, I had a toy elephant, and you'll still see it with me. I must have been about 3 or 4 years when I got this toy elephant from a zoo set. And I remember my grandmother taking some red paint, and in fact the mark of the red paint is still all these years on this toy elephant, and putting a buto on the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, okay, there's your Ganesha, go and play with it. And maybe I was interfering with her Ganesha at her shrine, so she tried to occupy me with my own Ganesha. So that little toy elephant has become a wonderful symbol of Ganesha. And so, yeah, Ganesha has always been, in a sense, a part of my devotion and part of my spiritual path. He is that aspect of Lord Shiva that comes to remove our obstacles. He's the remover of obstacles. Why do we picture him as an elephant? Because if you've seen wild elephants run through a jungle, can anything stand in their path? You know, they literally flatten down everything that's in their path. And so when the Indians wanted to perceive God as the remover of obstacle, they naturally saw an elephant, you know, the image of an elephant. And so before we even can get close to God, God has to come to us and remove the obstacles that prevent us from coming close to Him. So you see, the entire work of the soul progressing towards God is God's work. I can't do it on my own, you see. He has to first come and remove the obstacles of my ignorance, the obstacles of my blindness, that I may move towards Him. There's many similarities, in fact, between Lord Ganesha and Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the story of Ganesha, he has a human head at first, and then he loses that head at the wrath of Shiva because of the human arrogance that prevents him from entering into the, prevents, that tries to prevent Shiva from entering into the inner chamber where Mother Parvati was. And so Ganesha, in a sense, dies, but then an elephant head is put on him and he rises with higher wisdom. And so the symbol of the death and resurrection of Jesus is there in the story of Ganesha. Also, the story says that Mother Parvati formed Ganesha herself, you know, without the aid of Lord Shiva, and breathed life into him. So Ganesha has a virgin birth in the story, like Jesus. Interesting, the name Ganesha means Lord of Hosts, the one who is Lord of the armies of Lord Shiva. Mm. This very title is given to Jesus in the book of Revelation. Ganesha is the firstborn son of God. Jesus is described as the firstborn son of God. So you see the resonance that's over there between Christ and Ganesha. And obviously I resonate with that as a Christian, because I see Jesus coming as the remover of my ignorance and leading me to moksha, to salvation, even when I stand before Ganesha. Ganesha is a broken tusk, reminding us that God is prepared to sacrifice of himself for our salvation. You know, he broke the tusk and gave it for the writing of the Mahabharata in the story. And it's a reminder that God is prepared to sacrifice himself. And that's what Jesus shows on the cross when he sacrifices himself. Ganesha Lambodaraya has this huge belly, symbolic that he contains all things within himself. When the scriptures speak of Christ, they say, through him all things were created, and in him all things hold together. So Ganesha holds all things together in the symbol of the huge belly. And so these are some of the thoughts and some of the experiences I have as I enter the temple and first interact with the one God who's manifesting as Ganesha. And then I go around the temple and I come to an image of Lord Muruga, who's also seen as a manifestation of the Son of God. He is, Muruga for me is the light of God that guides me, you know. In fact, one of the names we give to Muruga is Swaminathan, which means the guru of the Lord, the one who, the Swami of Nathan, of the Lord. And because the story goes that he actually explains Pranava, the meaning of home, to Shiva. So he is actually the wisdom of Shiva manifest, the light of Shiva manifesting. He is the guru himself. We often call him Guga, the inner cave, the inner guru that guides us. And so I encounter Muruga as the light of God. So you see, God first comes and removes my obstacles. But now the path is clear, but I don't know how to walk on this path. So he now comes as Muruga, as the light, to guide me on the path. So he removes the obstacles and then he lightens up the path so that I may walk on the path. And so having greeted Lord Muruga, and obviously Muruga has a special meaning for me. You know, my family, our Kuludeva, is Muruga, the family deity is Muruga. In fact, my grandfather's name is Swaminathan, which is Muruga's name. My grandmother's name was Shanmugavalli, which is one of the two consorts of Lord Muruga. And my name is Kumaran, which is also Muruga's name, yes, the divine son. So Muruga also is an invitation for me to awaken to my own inner light, is an invitation for me to journey within. And so having received this light of God in the form of Muruga, then I dare to go deeper into the temple. And when you go into most temples in Tamil Nadu, before the main sanctum, you'll find three objects of worship. There's the sacrificial altar called the Bali Pidam. And then there's the flag pole, the Kodimaram. And then you get the Vagana, the vehicle, yes, of the god. And the way I internalize this is this way. At the Bali Pidam, the sacrificial altar, which is that sort of upside down lotus figure, I stand there and I say, I sacrifice here all my negativity. I sacrifice all my ego. As I come to you, Shiva, I want to come as pure as I can. Then I pray at the flag post, you know, and I acknowledge that flag is a reminder that this territory is God's territory, that I'm entering into a sacred territory. I'm entering into the territory of the King of Kings, and I let my consciousness and my awareness rise up like that flag, leaving the base things behind. And as I set my mind on those higher thoughts, like that flag that's raised up, I start to move closer. And then I come to Nandi, who is the vehicle of Lord Shiva. And Nandi is really me. You see, Nandi is the soul. And I say to Nandi, you know, you're so privileged that you get to carry the one who carries the universe. What a privilege you have. May I be like you at the end of this process. When I leave this temple, may I be the Vagana that carries Shiva in my heart. He's always there, but may I realize that I am carrying him with me. So after greeting Nandi, I then go inside the temple. And when you come into the inner court of the temple, in Arunachaleshwara, for example, they have the 63 Nayanmas, the 63 Saivite saints there. And first they have the four great Saivite saints, Happar, Thiruyana, Sambandar, Sundara and Manikavasaga. And as I look at these saints and I see their devotion for Shiva, naturally great love starts to rise up within me for Shiva. And then I walk around the shrine, and the first form in which I see Shiva now is in the form of Dakshinamurti. Dakshinamurti is Shiva in the form of Guru teaching in silence. Teaching in silence, and the four sons of Brahma, the mind-born sons of Brahma, seated there receiving the supreme instruction from Shiva in silence. And so I say, in the silence of the inner sanctum of my heart, which is symbolized by the inner sanctum, I'm going to enter in the temple, instruct me in the path of spirituality, draw me into your own silence. And so that's how I greet Lord Dakshinamurti. And then as you move around the shrine, you come to Lingot Bhava, which is special to Arunachala, you know. Lingot Bhava is the pillar of fire, which Arunachala appeared as. So the story of Arunachala is this, if I may just say it quickly. Shiva appeared as a pillar of fire, which had no height and no depth. And so Brahma could not find the height and Vishnu could not find the depth of this fire, of the Supreme. And in the Bible, in fact, when God appears in the Old Testament, he appears as a pillar of fire. The exact same words are used. And so the father of Jesus, who appeared to the Israelites as a pillar of fire, appeared to our ancestors in southern India as Arunachala, this pillar of fire. And Vishnu and Brahma, when they come back and say, we could not find the height nor the depth, they say to Shiva, please don't let this pillar of fire disappear. Leave us a sign that you are with humanity, that for all generations to come, they may be reminded that you are with them. And so that pillar of fire cools down into the mountain, Arunachala. So in the first yuga, it was a pillar of fire. In the second yuga, it was a mountain of gems, of sapphire. In the third yuga, it became a mountain of gold. And in this Kali yuga, it's become a mountain of rock. And so that Mount Arunachala is the actual presence of Shiva. In fact, a common saying in Tiruvannamalai is that in Kailash, he sits on Kailash.
Mm-hmm.
But in Tiruvannamalai, he is the mountain itself. The mountain is Arunachala. So this Lingot Baba, when I come before it, I'm encountering this mystery of Arunachala that has no height and has no depth. And at there, I sometimes would say, you are beyond anything. You know, I can't find the height and the depth of you. So lead me into this mystery that's beyond anything my mind can ever comprehend. And then having moved from Lingot Baba, and as you come in now closer to the shrine, at the main shrine, just before you get into the inner sanctum, you encounter the image of Lord Shiva Nataraja. Now, I could speak for hours on Shiva Nataraja, but basically Shiva Nataraja is Shiva as the cosmic dancer. And he, through that energy of the dance, he causes the entire cosmos to come into existence, and through that same energy draws the entire cosmos into him. So that whole process of evolution and the returning of the universe back to God is activated by the dance of Shiva Nataraja. And so even in the church we have a song that speaks of Christ dancing as the Lord of the dance. And I think quantum physics now even speaks of how the atoms move in a sort of rhythmic dance, you know. So,
In fact, that's what Dr. Abdul Kalam, former President of India, and a great physicist, in his book, The Wings of Fire, he says that when he looked at the electrons and the protons and the neutrons inside the atom, what he got reminded of was the dance of Shiva.
Exactly. So I stand before Nataraja, you know, and when I stand before Nataraja, I'm looking at the cause of the whole of creation at that moment. Sometimes I just sit there silently and just become aware of my own heartbeat.
Because
the rhythm of the dance is there in the heartbeat. And acknowledge that every breath, every movement, everything is imbued with this dance of Lord Shiva Nataraja. What a beautiful image.
Amazing.
Absolutely. And you know, just one more part of the image that I love is Lord Nataraja, you know, is dancing on the dwarf Muyalakan, which symbolizes ignorance and stunted growth, because ignorance prevents us from growing. So he's stamping out our ignorance, but his one hand is pointing to his foot and his other hand is raised in blessing, in Abhaya Mudra. And when I look at that, it's as if I'm literally hearing those words of, if you submit at my feet, if you constantly, Kumaran, allow yourself to surrender at my feet, which I'm pointing to, then you need not fear anything. You need not fear anything. And so with that assurance, I surrender again, and now I move into the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum. And when I enter that inner sanctum, I'm very aware that I'm entering into not a physical space. For me, it's an awareness that I'm entering into a space that transcends space. I'm entering into a timeless dimension. And I'm about to encounter the center of the universe, that which everything revolves around. And there in the inner sanctum, in the dark inner sanctum, which symbolizes the mystery in which God is veiled, is the Shiva Lingam. Now, how I understand the Shiva Lingam is this: that pillar of fire that came, when it cools down, it forms the form of this black pillar. And so it symbolizes this central pole, kind of like the North Pole and South Pole around which the world revolves. The Shiva Lingam is that center, it is Shiva, around which the entire cosmos revolves, you see. And so it is that place of birthing, it is that place of origin, it is the formless form of the Supreme, you know. Many people also see it as the feminine and the masculine coming together. And that again is a beautiful symbol. You know, we shouldn't approach it with base minds that think of just sex as such, you know, because a lot of people have mocked the image saying, oh, it's a symbol of a male and female organs of reproduction. No, it's a reminder beyond that, that God is Mother Father who gives birth to the universe, Shiva Shakti. So it may also be seen as that. But for me, it is that point of origin. It is the source of everything. It's the thing around which everything revolves. And so, even though we sometimes only can stand a few seconds because the crowds are so long, that one glimpse of the inner sanctum, the darshan of Lord Shiva, draws me inward to experience the inward pillar of fire, the Agni Lingam burning inside me.
In fact, in all the episodes of Lingodbhavam that we have seen in Puttaparthi, whenever we talk about Lingam, what always comes to my mind is that spherical, elliptical object that Baba used to manifest from himself. And that used to be oval-shaped.
Right.
And Baba used to say, just like this oval shape has no beginning and no end, that is what divinity is, and that is what it symbolizes.
Yes.
And to my mind, that's why the Lingam is always oval-shaped and without no beginning, no end, no... Swami says, Niyate Gamyateti Lingam, which means it has no beginning and it has no end.
Yeah, but also the oval shape would represent an egg, you know?
Yes.
If you look at an egg, and so again, the source of origin, as life comes from the egg, so all life comes from that.
Yes.
So the Shiva Lingam, you know, has many meanings, and it's a mystery in itself, but it definitely is one of the oldest images of divinity that mankind was used to worshipping. You know, we find forms of it in many civilizations, as pillar-like forms that have been worshipped. So there's a mystery around it, but as I was explaining, for me it symbolizes that center around which everything revolves.
It's interesting you described about the Arunachala temple and the first bhajan that Baba sang after he declared his avatarhood at the age of 14, Manasa Bhajare Guricharanam. The bhajan has the penultimate line as Arunachala Shiva. It says Arunachala Shiva, Arunachala Shiva, Arunachala Shiva.
For me, you know, in Chidambaram, Shiva is dancing with Mother Shakti as Sivagami standing beside him. But in Arunachala, he is still, you know, as the mountain of fire. And the story is that Ardhana Ishwara takes place there, that the Shakti becomes one with Shiva at Arunachala. This is what the Puranas say, that she was doing tapas, and then she said to Shiva, I don't want to just come and sit with you on Kailash anymore, I want to be one with you.
All the time.
Yeah, so she's absorbed into him. And so that unity of Shiva and Shakti take place. So Ardhana Ishwara, in fact, before they light the fire on the mountain on Kartikeya Deepam, only once a year the statue of Ardhana Ishwara is brought out of the temple. And so they bring Ardhana Ishwara out, and that image of Shiva Shakti dances and very quickly goes back into the temple. And only after that happens do they light the Deepam on the hill, the fire once a year for Kartikeya Deepam. So for me, it's again this absorption back into God. It's this balancing of the dualities.
Yes.
It's the absolute stillness. It's the supreme. It's the supreme experience. One needs to experience the concept of Arunachala to reach the height of God consciousness. Yeah.
In fact, that also reminds me of what Baba once said of this meaning of the word Yeshu. Baba said, Ye means one.
Right.
And Su means divinity.
Right.
Sachidananda and everything that is divine.
Right.
So what it means is Yeshu means just one divine. Just the oneness of divinity.
That's a nice interpretation of it, yeah. In the Hebrew scriptures, the word Yeshu means the one who saves, because it has Hebrew root. It could be interpreted as I am the one who saves. So, and what is salvation? It's really bring us back to that point of union with God. This is the mission that Jesus comes with. If I may continue, when you come out of the shrine of Lord Shiva in Arunachala, the next street is the shrine of Mother Shakti.
Yes.
And if I may just speak about Mother Shakti for a while. So having experienced Shiva as the absolute, then we start to experience his power within us manifesting, which is Shakti, the Divine Mother. So, I mean, the process is very clear. The spiritual path is marked out in the deities. God comes and removes our obstacles as Ganesha. He gives us light on this path that he has cleared as Muruga. He draws us to experience him in his many forms. And then we experience the Absolute represented in the Shiva Lingam of the inner sanctum. And then we feel his power in us, which is that power we call Shakti, the Divine Mother of the universe. And so it's natural after experiencing the Supreme to move into the Mother Shrine. And in Arunachala Yeshwara Temple, Mother is called Unamule Amman. Unamule meaning the one who has not suckled at the breast. And what that means is that even though she is the Mother of the universe, she does not have an attachment to that which she has created. You know, a mother's attachment to a child is very often seen with the child suckling at the mother's breast. And it shows Shakti as a self-sufficient one who gives everything and yet is not bound to the Maya and the Prakriti and the creation that she herself manifests. She is in it, but she is beyond it. She gives birth to it, but she is beyond it. I also like to see it in another way, in the sense of the one who is the mother of the universe herself has not suckled at any breast. She feeds everything, but she herself has not fed on anything, because she is the ultimate source. So when you walk into the temple, you'll see many carvings of the Divine Mother. And it was really special for me to keep Navratri this year in Arunachala Temple and to worship the Divine Mother in all her forms. One of the forms in the temple is the form of Mother as Durga, Mahishasura Madini, the one who destroys the demon Mahishasura. And I love that image of Mother because it's a very powerful image, you know.
The imagery of Mother Kali?
Yes, from that image of Durga, then the image of Mother Kali comes, you know. But Durga gives me a sense of, what have I got to fear if my mother is so powerful, you know? Why do I fear all these mundane things? Why do I have doubts about tomorrow? This is my mother, very powerful, very defensive, very protective. She will take care of me. And then there's that image of Mother Kali, you know, that at first sight looks very terrifying. But like Ramakrishna, I've come to love this image of Mother Kali because it's actually become an image of love for me, not an image of terror. Maybe we can look at the just some of the symbolism of Mother Kali for a while, because I think especially people who come from the West and experience Hinduism for the first time, they see Kali and they're quite shocked at this image of one whose tongue is sticking out and whose hands are dripping with blood and many weapons, and she has severed hands tied around her as a skirt. She's naked and she's wearing this garland of skulls. You know, it's a very bloody, scary image almost. But when I look at Mother Kali, this is what I see. You see, those many skulls around her head is a reminder of how many times the mother needs to slay the false perceptions I have in this mind. That she has to constantly slay this ego to liberate me. She has constantly to slay all the thoughts that have created a false sense of identity that prevent me from acknowledging
all those demons within us.
Yeah. So she has to slay this mind. You know? So when I look at those skulls around her, I say, oh, how gracious you are, Mother, how loving, because I can't overcome these thoughts myself. I can't overcome these false perceptions myself. So you come, Mother, you slay them, that I may awaken to true wisdom. You see, the hands that have been severed and put around as a skirt remind me of a verse in the Bible which says, not by power nor by might, but by my spirit, says the Lord. And so it reminds me of another verse from the Bible which says, "For by grace you have been saved by faith, and this is not through your own works, it is the gift of God." And so Mother Kali again is reminding me of the graciousness of God, not fear, but the graciousness.
He's lifting us with so many hands.
Yes, exactly. And then all her hands itself is symbolic of the power and the omnipotence of God. Just one more image of Shiva that sometimes creates confusion, of Kali that creates confusion. She's often dancing on Shiva underneath us.
Yes.
And that reminds me that she emerges from Shiva himself, that he is the foundation from which she comes. But also, when Shiva in the story sees that his own wrath in the form of Kali is so unmanageable, it's destroying everything because it's so radical, you see. It wants to return everything immediately back to Shiva consciousness, so it's just destroying everything. He himself steps off his throne and he comes and sacrifices himself to his own wrath. So when Kali sees she's danced on Shiva, she's shocked, her tongue sticks out, you know. She's amazed. And what happens here is divine love conquers divine justice.
Yes.
Divine justice is absorbed into divine love. This love is a story of Christ on the cross.
Love
Christ
conquers everything.
Yeah, Christ sacrificing himself for us. So that's my experience in the temple. And then I leave the temple with this great sense of being in the arms of the Divine Mother, with Shiva consciousness is shrined deep within me. And I try with His grace to carry that out into my daily life.
Wonderful. I think that's so phenomenal. I really feel like discussing this further, because, you know, even as you described the image of Mother Kali, so many beautiful imageries emerge. And I think everyone who listens to this will look at this shrine and look at this different deities in new light. And that way, it no more becomes again a ritual, but it becomes spiritual. Sure. It becomes another step in our inner journey. Thank you very much, Father.
Thank you. Namah Shivaya.
So that was the discussion that I had with Father Francis Kumaran Subrayan from South Africa, an Anglican priest who is currently pursuing his sadhana in Tiruvannamalai. And as he said, every imagery of Shiva, every deity who constitute the family of Shiva, Shiva, Shakti, Ganesha, Muruga, they are all such fascinating facets of the divine. And just like creation is so varied, every person is so different. To me it appears like God has given us so many options. Someone would like a Lord who is so playful, who is one with so many mysterious miracles around him. Someone would like Krishna, someone would be like an ascetic, so someone would like Shiva, someone would like a Ganesha, someone would like a Kartikeya. And so these are all different facets, different ways that we can relate to that infinite one. And it is on these occasions like Shivaratri, when Bhagwan gave those discourses, you saw how Bhagwan revealed to us that there is only one. He used to always say that there is only one God, and everything is after that is just to facilitate us to think of Him. And Shivaratri is the night when we can make that effort, that concerted effort towards that direction. And just to make it easy for us, Swami always had this 12 hours of Akhand Bhajan on every Shivaratri. So from 6 p.m. on 28th evening till 6 a.m. on 1st March morning, you will have in Prashanti as well as in so many places in India and elsewhere all over the world, we have the Shivaratri bhajans. And Swami says it is not only in this night alone that you should spend in the thought of Shiva, but your whole life actually should be lived in that constant presence of the Lord. That endeavor, that pursuit should always be there to attain that consummation with the Lord. And Swami says, even though who deny God, even they will have to tread the pilgrim road one day or the other. Those who deny God are only denying themselves and their glory. All have love in them in some form or the other? Is there anyone in this world who cannot relate to love? Is there anyone in this love who doesn't love at least one other person in this love, in this world? If you believe in love, you believe in God. That love is God. That is a spark of God. And Swami says, however small or temporary, if you have love in your heart, you will experience bliss. And that is the spark of the divine. But for us to experience this on a continuous basis, for us to become that bliss, so that we are perennially, eternally in that, we need to make that effort. And Shivratri is one occasion when we can take one more step to purify ourselves and be lost in B-A-B-A, being awareness, bliss, Atman. That is what is Baba. That is what is Shiva. That is what is the Shiva consciousness, Sat, Chit, Ananda, constant integrated awareness, awareness that we are He and everything is He and He is only one, and that one is love. As Bhagwan said, I separated myself from myself so that I can love myself. So love is at the bottom of everything. Love is what is the source of everything, and to love everything finally merges into. So let us spend this festival in cultivating this precious virtue and elevating our lives, celebrating our lives, beautifying our lives and filling it with happiness, joy. So with these thoughts, I leave you on this night as we wait to celebrate this beautiful festival. Thank you so much for being with us all the day through, listening to our variety of programs on this Thursday Live. Please feel free to send us your feedback. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. We'll be eager to know what you feel about our offering so that we can make it better week after week. And we really offer our gratitude to Bhagwan for having given us this opportunity to contemplate on Him, to think about Him, to thank Him and to share His love and His message. Let us take this opportunity to not only dwell but also disseminate this good news, this powerful message, and make this world a Sai world, a world where everyone has one more smile on the face, where we live not for ourselves but for others. As I quit, you will continue to listen to a program which was performed in the Sai Kulwant Hall just a couple of days ago. It was a drama on the life of the revered Chinese sage Confucius, presented during the Chinese New Year celebrated in Prashantinilayam on 6th February 2014, just in this a week or so ago in Prashantinilayam in this month. So we'll continue to listen to this program. So thank you so much. And finally, as I take leave, a loving Sai Ram and a good night from Prashantinilayam. Have a great day and a great time with the Lord. Thank you so much. Sai Ram.